perhaps time for us to say there are times to have elections and there are times not to have. Samira, in terms of Somalia, and actually Somaliland, if you might think about the election that they just had, people are quite happy, or it was hailed around the world. There was a transfer of power, but there wasn't a single woman who was elected in there. So again, should we take the idea of elections with a pinch of salt? Do they just further some of the divisions and the problematics that might be present in society?
In my view, I think elections do provide, you know, at least some hope that things will get better. And you see some incremental change with each cycle, especially in Somalia. I mean, you had the 2000 transitional national government replaced in 2004 by a process that was, overseen in Kenya. And then you had, the elections in 2012 that both Hassan Sheikh, again, the elections of both President Farmajo, of course, not universal suffrage per se, but, you know, at least there was incremental change. And I think in the context of Southern Somalia, at least that's positive. And without that, it would be the jungle law. I don't think, the actors in Somalia would sit passively without a process that, you know, at least look like it would change something every 4 years. So I think it's in that sense, elections are good. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that the Somaliland election, where you do not have a single woman, is sometimes a reflection of society. And so does the society know 100% what's best for them? Should there be checks and balances when it comes to those basics, women representation, you know, people with disabilities, minorities, the marginalized? Should there be accommodation for them in processes like the ones in Somalia? I think definitely there's an argument for that. But then also on the Somaliland elections, you know, there's a romanticization that there's been several peaceful elections. But, you know, political disputes in Somaliland are usually settled through local means, not, you know, through this electoral process. It's important that you should know that both the presidential and parliamentary elections have been delayed several times. The upper house has been sitting since the 1990s. The Somaliland parliament was last elected in 2005 until this year. So that was, they overstayed more than 10 years. So it is true that in the north, the traditional resolution performs better than in the south, but it's more institutionalized and cultured as compared to what you see in the south.
Rashid, is there scope for institutionalizing indigenous forms of governance, what we might call it indigenous democracy, I suppose. But is there scope for doing that in countries such as Ethiopia, where you've got huge, you know, disparities? You've got different ethnic groups, different traditions, different, to a sense, histories. Do you think it, I mean, unlike Somalia, obviously, which for a lot of people is seen as homogeneous. Do you think that their example might be something that Ethiopia might look towards?
I think Ethiopia and Somalia are quite different. Ethiopia has remained throughout, I think, a strong state with strong institutions. And that is why I said, even in the midst of conflict, you had actually the Electoral Commission actually performing very well. And that, I think, is one of the benefits of having a strong state with the fundamental structures still intact. Now, Somalia has been without a government for the last 30 years. And as Samira has said, a lot of the power has reverted back to the clans. And it is the clans that wield influence. Now, I'm not... I don't want to give this Eurocentric vision and say that democracy, Africans have never had democracy. If you look at literature and history, actually, you'll be surprised to learn that Somalis were actually called a pastoral democracy. They had a very robust systems of very egalitarian and inclusive systems of government before colonialism. So I think it is about an enlightened leadership, marrying what is good in the tradition and modernizing it. And we see similar, in the case of Somaliland, that kind of a potential where you had the Gurti or the Council of Elders actually providing a sort of an umbrella or a sort of a safety net for that nascent democracy. And I think the progress Somaliland has made is largely because of that ability of creating a hybrid system with the modernizing liberal style democracy plus indigenous forms of governance. In Somalia, you also had similar structures, but as Samira has said, the North has tended to have that better for a variety of reasons. One of them based on a very hypothetical historical notion that the Brits were better at nurturing indigenous systems, and the Italians were basically going and smashing indigenous systems. I don't want to go that far, but that is one theory which is out there. But all I can say is that Ethiopia actually is an interesting case where you can actually build institutional democracy. In Somalia, the institutional system has been hijacked by elite compacting. Look at the electoral process in Somalia for the last, since 2000 up to today. It is actually not led by institutions. The Electoral Commission is all but in name. It is actually about the regional leaders coming and meeting the president and modifying electoral rules as they go along. The electoral model has been modified close to 6 times now in Somalia, and largely not through institutions, not through the electoral system, electoral agency, but through elite compacts, the regional leaders and the president coming together. So I think between Ethiopia and Somalia, you have two radical and very different systems of government. One with the fundamental structures of a strong state still intact. Another one, having that kind of rudimentary structures, but now hijacked by an elite, which I don't think is interested in really democratization. And that, I think, is the dilemma which Somalia faces.
But Rashid, if we had a pastoral democracy that didn't engage in this big event we call an election, doesn't that raise a question whether we still need to have it? I mean, just because the kind of modernistic idea of democracy involves a big event that everybody turns up to vote, doesn't mean that we need to necessarily go and keep replicating it, especially when it clearly for many societies is not working.
I hear you, Patrick, but I tend to share Professor Justin Willis's idea that this ritual of democracy has its own utility and psychological functions. I think even if it has become hollowed out, people become accustomed to the idea, and as we have seen even in Ethiopia, you had at the national level a very corrupt rigged process, but down in the grassroots you actually had real competition, and that I think is some of the functions, the benefits that accrue from having this kind of cyclical elections. Of course, that doesn't mean that we don't need to refine it and improve it. And we are in a sorry state in the whole. But that said, I think the symbolism itself and this repeated exercise, I think, carries its own weight. So I still think that, we shouldn't abolish elections the way Isaias Afewerki has done for the last 30 years.
I don't think even Isaias would argue that what he has in Eritrea is a democracy. But what I'm wondering, Justin, is whether, given that there seems to be places, or levels at which elections work, deliver some form of accountability, and even in Kenya, you might think of how at the level of MPs, of members of parliament, you see there is quite a lot of competition, and elections pretty much are accepted at that level. But there are other levels where they're clearly problematic and can lead to violent outcomes. Whether we might need to adopt a more nuanced idea of how elections should work. I'm always afraid of this term of African democracy, that it's somehow, we are different from everybody else. We've got to have things differently. But is there scope for that? What do you think?
Yeah, well, like you, I'm a little skeptical about kind of African democracy as an idea, both because it kind of collectivizes a whole continent, but also because it kind of then differentiates everybody on that continent somehow. I mean, it seems to me that kind of people in Africa kind of, there's lots of enthusiasm for voting and for the idea of having a voice through voting, just as there is in other parts of the world. It's, yeah, this is actually, this is quite an appealing idea for humans, I think. But that question, and kind of going back to Rashi's point about kind of the pastoral democracy. Well, of course, the point about pastoral democracy was that the stakes and the institutional terrain were a little bit different to those of, say, Somalia or Kenya as governments operating in an international system of states, right? So it's not necessarily straightforward to translate forms of egalitarian or consensual government from one context into another. And I think we have to kind of be a little bit careful about where people say, oh, you know, kind of this society, yeah, it's super consensual historically and culturally, so, you know, we don't need votes. But there's a kind of lot of stuff, you know, human society in the 21st century tends to be extremely complicated in its institutional and economic forms, right? And I'm not saying that human society in the past wasn't complicated. It's just become complicated in slightly more different ways. And so just translating kind of real or imagined former institutions onto the present won't necessarily work. I would say, though, I mean, to go back to kind of my big theme, I suppose, which is I think that elections do something. I think that elections can do powerful political work, and that can be quite good, powerful political work. But by themselves, they're not really going to change anything. They have to be embedded in a set of other institutions and practices. And so we probably do need to think quite carefully about what they're going to do in particular circumstances, and in some cases, you know, where the effort should go in terms
of pretty much
ensuring that people have a voice, ensuring that there is some kind of accountability.
Right. So pretty much the idea that there's this one template of how to run a democratic country, that's kind of imaginary. It doesn't work.
Well, yeah, it's imaginary. Actually, if you look at countries that would style themselves as electoral democracies, actually they're all different. Right. I mean, they mostly have in common that they have universal suffrage. But in terms of their constitutions and the structures and their legal structures, I mean, there are loads of different ways of doing this. Right. So we shouldn't imagine that the secret ballot is itself the key to governmentality. Right. It's a particular form of political engagement, which can have, I think, in certain contexts in our world, quite a lot of benefits. But it doesn't in itself kind of deliver political change or make everyone's life immediately better. And we have to think about it in kind of context, right?
Well,
I mean, that's really obvious. And if everyone's listening thinking, oh, it's really obvious, it is really obvious. But I'm not sure we've always thought about it quite so clearly. Sorry.
Well, I get what you're saying. I don't know that we still have you, Samira. I don't know whether you want to address those, Samira, and then we can go around.
Thanks, Patrick. And just to touch on just what you guys were talking about a few seconds ago, I think replacing elections or this system, it might be too late, you know, especially for the Horn of Africa. The horse is out of the stable, per se. The allure of what modern state system offers to Somali actors and the competition that exists within them, between them, and why they aspire to gain leadership, to dominate others, I think it's irreversible, and we just have to make do and find out a way of balancing those competing interests. But on the 4.5 system, I think it is, especially for women and for minorities and for the marginalized, extremely discriminatory. But at the end of the day, it came about because of a challenge that existed. State collapse 10 years after state collapse, there was no other way to agree on, you know, coming around the table and reinstituting the state. And so it was a solution to that. And I don't think replacing it in the midst of the current electoral process would be a solution. We do want to go to one person, one vote, and that would change things, but they should be a process by which you can get from point A to B. And everyone agrees it's time to move on from this system, but I don't think it's time yet.
Actually, before I come to Rashid, Justin, and I think this was kind of quite a big point in your book, regarding this sort of ethnic affiliation and how people organize ethnically when it comes to electoral competition, and the tension between that and the civic virtue, which I think would be, in the case of Somalia, well encapsulated in this idea of the 4.5 versus the one man, one vote thing. Do you think, as clearly Francis thinks, that ethnic affiliation is a problem when it comes to democracy in the region and perhaps wider in Africa more widely?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, ethnicity is one of the ways that people make claims on one another and on those who represent them. Now, if this turns into a kind of, we have to get our person into state house at all costs, that obviously can be very problematic. But at a very local level, I mean, I think you've already said this, Patrick, if you look at Kenya's elections, actually, if you look at elections in a number of places, the vitality and vigor of local discussions about morality and what leaders should do often derives partly from a shared sense of ethnic membership and collective membership. So there is a kind of accountability, and there is a kind of sense of, I have a right to talk about this because I'm part of this group, and these are the moral forms of behavior. And that sits uncomfortably with straightforward ideas of national citizenship, the idea that you should only and always be a national citizen. Of course, immediately, kind of membership of an ethnic group is in tension with that. But that tension doesn't always have to be wholly destructive. And also, to be quite honest, it's not going to go away anyway. So even, we cannot kind of pretend that people's daily lives and the assumptions they make about the behavior of others and what their obligations are to others are just going to vanish from politics, because they won't. And right. So, I mean, we have to accept that actually politics has to work along with this, maybe to mitigate some of the worst aspects of it, but to think about, okay, these people live real lives, and the politics in which they engage have to be part of those real lives. Otherwise, they won't mean anything to them.
Right. Rashid, what do you think? I think Ethiopia had, and put in its constitution, sort of this ethnic blocks and built a system, everybody belonging to. Do you think that has made elections easier or more contested? Has it had any effect on how elections are done? Or perceived?
I think it is definitely a very complex country, and also the issue of ethnicity and ethnic politics, ethnic identity politics, and ethno-regionalism, is a problem in Ethiopia. But I think the genius of the EPRDF government was actually not to shy away from the ethnic nature of the state, and to try to actually find ways to harness ethnicity into a sort of a positive force that can transform Ethiopia, and that is why I think Meles and his people conceived of the idea of an ethnic federal model that actually was very radical and allowed ethnic states to actually secede if they want to. Now, the problem was actually the way in which the ethnic federal system was implemented. In many ways, the EPRDF never let go of power. So a lot of the federal states were just states in name. Power was still centralized and controlled from the center, and never resources and power were held at the center and never dispersed. And I think that is what led eventually to the tensions and the crisis we have seen in Ethiopia in recent years. But I think there is a positive aspect in Ethiopia's politics, in the sense that people don't run away about ethnicity. They are not neurotic like Kenyans about ethnicity. who outside there, they claim they are liberals and they're progressives. And then back home, when they speak in their mother tongue, they end up, and the same thing with my Somali cousins as well. is the same problem we have everywhere. And so I think once you put ethnicity out there and you have ethnic parties emerge and then they coalesce around a coalition, actually the most interesting thing that has happened in the current elections, in the recent elections, is that people were debating manifestos, party manifestos at the local level. This was what decided. People were asking, are you going to promise us this? You know, there were town hall meetings in which people actually appeared to explain their manifestos. Now, in a heavily ethnicized, political system, nobody interrogates a politician on their manifesto. In Kenya,
right. So could it be, Rashid, could it then be the case that, for example, by accepting that society is organized along ethnic lines and implementing a system that acknowledges that you basically take it off the table and people can actually get to discuss more important things?
Yes, and I'm a realist. You know, I accept what Justin has just said, which is that ethnicity is going to be, the organizing principle of politics for generations to come. This is how we are wired. We are not going to run away from. Now, the thing, but can you plan progressively to build a system of government that is inclusive, that does not, whereby ethnicity does not actually divide, in which you do not create ethnic dictatorships? And I think that is the challenge before the current generations of Africans, is how to acknowledge the reality of ethnicity, the potential benefits of actually harnessing ethnic identity into building a much more bigger collective identity. It's all a matter of the way the state is structured and the incentive which the political system gives to ethnic states. Kenya, for example, is now devolved in some senses, but that the devolution is not necessarily ethnic, but you can see the tensions where you have now the competition devolved towards the periphery, where you have very intense competition between the subclans, between the sub-groups, ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the dilemma. Unless there is a system which arbitrates and allocates resources and power much more equitably, I think we are going to have problems. But I'm all for the idea of not throwing away ethnic identity, but only progressively reforming it and harnessing it into molding it into a positive force. Back to you.
Samira, do you think our so-called founding fathers had it wrong when they told us tribalism was a bad thing?
Yeah, I think they did have it right. There's an aspect of negative tribalism that comes into play, and like Rashid just said, especially with us, the Somalis, there's this elite, the elitism, depending on which clan you come from, and othering other clans and other communities. So I think we did have it right. But what's wrong, what I think is wrong, is underestimating the dominant thinking when it comes to clan, especially for Somalia. You know, clan and Islam are central, and trying to create systems that do not involve the two aspects of Somali people, I think is problematic.